Sports Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. I'm coming to you live today from Biden Field, where the Fresno State baseball team looks to win its sixth game in a row today. The Dogs take on San Jose State. You know, last weekend, baseball had me in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And one of the treats that I have in traveling around the country with the Bulldogs is that it allows me to meet more veterans all over the country. I call this show Hometown Heroes with the idea that no matter where you're from in this great country of ours, no matter how big or small your hometown is, there are some heroes in your hometown that you probably have no idea what those men and women might have done in years past to help preserve the freedom that we enjoy in this country. I've interviewed Doolittle Raiders in Montana, Pearl Harbor survivors in Hawaii, and prisoners of war in Idaho, just to name a few. And this past weekend, when the Bulldog baseball team was down in Las Cruces, I got to catch up with a Bataan Death March survivor. And I didn't know this until a couple trips ago to that part of the country, but there were more soldiers on the Bataan Death March from New Mexico than from any other state. Many of them came back to New Mexico after the war, and that region has had a strong connection to that very moving part of world history. More than 75,000 American and Filipino prisoners of war were forced to march 61 miles, and that's the short end of that journey. I've interviewed guys who were on it even before what's known as the Bataan Death March started. But back in 1942, that's what happened. And with the connection that New Mexico has to that unique event, there is a memorial constructed in 2001 in Las Cruces, the Bataan Death March Memorial, the only federally funded monument to soldiers who participated in that. It's a very touching tribute. It's a statue, and in front and behind of the statue are footprints in the concrete. Some of those footprints are made with boots, some with bare feet. And those barefoot footprints were actually made by Bataan Death March survivors. It is their actual footprints in the concrete there in Las Cruces. And I have some pictures linked on my blog at kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page where you can check that out. But I had a chance to talk to Julio Barella, 91 years old, and he is now the last remaining Bataan Death March survivor in the Las Cruces area. So by the end of this program, you're going to hear not only from Mr. Barella, but also in a new twist, you're going to hear from his daughter and hear how his status as a Bataan Death March survivor impacted her life, how thankful she is just to be here, because she wouldn't be here if he didn't beat really seemingly insurmountable odds to survive the Bataan Death March. So I think you'll really enjoy the program today. And what I'm going to do before we take our first break is I'm going to read to you a short narrative that Mr. Barella put together. And then after our first commercial break, you'll actually hear it in his words. But it really is unique. And Las Cruces has done a tremendous job of preserving that history of the Bataan Death March. So now I'm going to read for you the narrative that Mr. Barella himself put together before we get to his comments. And here it goes. He says, "My name is Julio T. Barella. I was born to Refugia and Guillermo Barella on September 28, 1918, just north of Las Cruces in a cotton field off of Highway 85, which was owned and farmed by the family. I lived in San Ysidro, a small community also north of Las Cruces and south of Doña Ana. I was the oldest of four boys and always wanted to join the service to travel around the world. I was 16 and I left home and arrived in Los Angeles to enlist in the Navy. But my mother found out, went to California, told them I was underage and brought me back home. I worked on my folks' farm until May 14, 1941, when I received a draft from the U.S. Army. I was the first one to get drafted in Doña Ana County just before World War II. I reported to Santa Fe, New Mexico. I was stationed at Fort Bliss in El Paso for basic training. I was at Fort Bliss from March 41 until August 1941. Several of us were merged with the National Guard unit known as the 200th Coast Artillery, Battery A. At the end of basic training, I was shipped to the Philippines on the President Pierce and assigned to Clark Field on a searchlight crew. The war started on December 8, 1941. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and approximately 8 hours later, they attacked Clark Field. The whole camp was bombed and destroyed in 40 minutes. The smoke was so thick, it turned into night. We started retreating to the Bataan Peninsula on Luzon Island. General King gave orders for us to march into the Maravillas Mountains. In the mountains, the men pitched small tents, which would sleep two soldiers. The food and ammunition ran out. We had eaten water buffalo and horses, which were used for the cavalry. General King surrendered, although General Wainwright didn't agree with him. In General King's defense, we had no food or ammunition, and many of the men were sick. So this is the narrative of Julio Borrello, who you'll hear from shortly, and he continues. General King surrendered the men in groups. We formed a long line and waved white T-shirts. The Japanese thought that surrender was disgraceful and the taking of your life was more honorable. In my religion, I was taught to take one's life as a mortal sin. My mother brought me up in the Catholic religion, a great believer in the Virgin of Guadalupe. She had my brother David dance with the danzantes and tortugas. I know that someone was watching over me, because when we surrendered, the Japanese came at us with their bayonets, searching and shooting some of us. Any soldier found with Japanese souvenirs was shot and killed on the spot. The Japanese put us in a large area in the jungle. Their tanks and machine guns were all positioned on us. I thought they were going to kill us. Then a large earthquake hit, and all their tanks pointed away from us, and their guns fell. I thought this was a sign. The Japanese were superstitious, and they didn't shoot us. I don't know exactly what they thought, but it was then that we started the Bataan Death March. With so many soldiers starving, wounded, and sick, we started the march. We were slapped, pushed, beaten, and yelled at while we marched to see what we were made of. If we slowed down, they would hit us with the butt of their rifles. I was hit often, and it made walking so much harder. Once you fell, you would be bayoneted and shot, sometimes beheaded. During the march, we would come upon heads on poles, which the Japanese had put there so we could see what would happen to us if we fell or spoke back or looked at them with hate. Our feet were bleeding and the skin was coming off. During the march, all I could think of was my mother and how much she would suffer if I died. Several times, I almost fell from exhaustion and the pain in my bloodied feet. Then I would remember her and the prayers she would say for me, and this gave me the courage to continue on. The 200th Coast Artillery was a very close unit, and we all would help each other by helping each other walk. We would hold each other up. We were all brothers. Occasionally, we would see some grass or a banana peel on the road. I encouraged my friend Lorenzo Benegas to chew on this, and it would create some moisture in our mouths. There were 1,800 of us from the 200th. Only 800 men came back. The Angels raged on the march from 16-year-olds to 60-year-olds. The whole 200th Regiment from New Mexico was deployed to the Philippines, and New Mexico suffered more casualties on the march than any other state in World War II. The march was 65 miles and took 5 days to make due to the sick, wounded, and 115-degree temperature without any water. The only water we were allowed to drink was from a water hole with dead water buffalo in it. A lot had already come down with malaria and dysentery. Another factor making the march so difficult was the anger the Japanese had because Corregidor was still fighting. Corregidor surrendered almost a month later. The Japanese would tell us to see what they, the Americans, were doing to us. I saw a lot of death and suffering of soldiers and also people who tried to help us by giving us whatever they could during the march. The village people were shot, set on fire, and beheaded for trying to help us. At the end of the march, we reached a place called San Fernando. Then we were put into boxcars like sardines. Many died from suffocation. We arrived in Capas, marched another 8 miles to Camp O'Donnell. From Camp O'Donnell, I was sent to Cabanatuan. I went through several camps and then shipped on one of the hell ships to Japan and onto a prison camp in Niigata. I was a prisoner of war for 3.5 years. So he states that very matter-of-factly, but when we come back, you'll hear the emotion in this 91-year-old's voice as he shares his experiences on the Bataan Death March. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, with you until 1:45 when I segue into Bulldog Baseball as the Dogs look for their sixth win in a row against San Jose State. Last week, I used some of my non-baseball time in New Mexico to make that beautiful drive from Las Cruces north to Truth or Consequences and the New Mexico State Veterans Home. I went there to meet up with the last Bataan Death March survivor in an area that had more men on the march than any other part of the United States. Julio Borrello is his name, and before the break, you heard me read a short narrative that Julio put together about his experiences. Now you're going to hear, in some parts more detail, and certainly throughout, more emotion from Julio himself. We'll start the interview with what he told me about how he ended up with the 200th Coast Artillery in the Philippines before World War II even started.
Well, I was about 21 year old. And then the draft came, and I was drafted, and we were supposed to serve 1 year. And then when we got there, they increased it to 18 months. And after the 18 months, it was increased again for all the duration of war. So we were there to serve for all the duration of war. I spent in the Philippines and Japan almost 5.5 years.
Right, because you were there in the Philippines before the war started.
And, of course, you weren't liberated in Japan till after the war ended. I read that all your equipment hadn't even been unpacked when the Japanese attacked. And I understand whatever equipment and supplies you did have wasn't anywhere near what you needed.
And we didn't have enough to fight with to begin with. So we did what we could until we ran out of everything. We ran out of food, too, so we ran out of ammunition. We didn't have any ammunition to fight. So we were forced to surrender. That was in Bataan.
And that was in April of 1942, 5 months after the war had started. And I'd like for you to shed a little light on those 5 months between being attacked at Clark Field and when the march started. Now, the unit you were with, everybody from New Mexico, and you were chosen especially because so many of you spoke Spanish, which they thought might come in handy in the Philippines. That was the 200th Coast Artillery, right?
200th Coast Artillery.
What kind of things were you expected to do? What were your duties?
Well, it was a 3-inch gun and 5-inch gun. And we had searchlights, power plant. We buried the power plant in order to get electricity to run the control stations.
But an artillery unit isn't much good when you run out of ammunition, huh?
Well, we run out of everything because we didn't have any way of fighting. We didn't have not even a power plant.
When you heard that you guys were being surrendered to the Japanese, what went through your mind? How did that make you feel, and what were you thinking?
The reason was this: they still called us the Death March. Well, they named the Death March, the Japanese named the Death March, because, you know, we didn't surrender when we were told. We were told at the very beginning of the war to surrender, and we didn't surrender. We tried to fight them. Something was wrong with the officers, I guess, because we were not told to surrender, so we didn't surrender. So we didn't surrender until we ran out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive, and there's where the death march started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go, and you're already starving, right?
Started at that march pretty weak. We were pretty weak then because we when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only 2 meals a day, and then they cut us to 1 meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat. So,
what kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted, and you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
To survive? Well, we used to hunt. We used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat, see. And part of them died in the death march, and then the other part died in the concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. It was just like this, see. I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, "Why, hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having as much trouble as I am having." The other boys, they feel the same way. We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because when they surrendered, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery, and all that. A lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk. By the Japanese, the ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punish me and they knock me down. And then I have in mind that if I try to stand up and get up, I won't be killed. So, see, that's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the Death March that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen statistically, outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much they can grab on a bowl of rice. And that's when the death march starts. They start walking without water. And then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat. And they were Filipinos. They would try to help us, give us food. They find out that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them or burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Skin and bones, huh?
Yeah.
And in addition to starving to death, you really had to live in constant fear of death. I know last year at the Convention for Bataan Survivors in Texas, the Japanese ambassador made a formal apology to survivors. But I don't know if a lot of people truly understand what happened all those years ago. I really don't want to fan any kind of flames of anger or resentment or anything like that. But I want to understand, and I think our listeners want to understand, you weren't just starving to death. You had reason to believe that you could be shot, you could be bayoneted, beheaded even, for something that not even that you did, but that one of your fellow prisoners did.
Oh, I tell you this, but you probably won't believe.
I'll believe you.
But you know, the concentration camp, when we were there, we were captured for at the very beginning. A lot of the prisoners of war tried to escape, and that escape made the Japs decide to divide the group in tens. So if one of the 10 survive, the other nine, they will kill them. And they kill a lot of Americans. People don't believe. Just the only people that believe, the people that saw that, the Filipinos. The Filipinos, they know that. They did that. They line them up and they shoot nine. I saw them with my eyes.
So they would execute the other nine prisoners in a group of 10 because of the one who tried to escape. I know it was truly a horrific experience, and I know it's not easy for you to talk about. So let's move on to a more pleasant topic, if you will. Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Cabanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship, and in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped, the war was coming to an end, and finally your camp at Niigata, Japan was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very, very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies very weak. We couldn't hardly do much work. We just hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us that the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp. So we stay there, you know, until the next day. Then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets saying that if we would clear the area, they will drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in, I would imagine, and you have described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
We had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And I don't know. And some people, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they didn't want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us, do you have any Japanese that we killed and all that? None.
Let me ask you this. How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home? Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
I dream more about them than I dream about my people, even today. Every day I remember about some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. Made it. I don't believe it. I went through all of that.
Well, it really is amazing, and I'm thankful that you're sharing some of your experiences with me and with our listeners today. When you think back now, it's been more than 68 years now since that death march started, and then, of course, you had the years of captivity that followed. But looking back now, why do you think it's important that people understand what happened to you and what happened to all those other prisoners?
It's something that I haven't seen before, and I don't think they'll ever see that again. I don't think the United States will go through that again. And I think that it's, for some people, it's unbelievable. This is what I have in mind. I hope the people, the modern people, will know what Japan did. Keep that in mind. What the Germans did. Keep that in mind.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we don't want to forget what happened because we don't want to take our freedom for granted, and we also don't want to ever see those kinds of atrocities again. Now, a couple more things I'd like for you to touch on if you can. You are the oldest of four boys, and I understand one of your brothers was serving in Okinawa after your liberation, but before you got back to the States, you actually got to talk with him on the telephone?
He called me, and he said, my God, he said, you made it. Yes, I am. Are you Julio? Yes, I'm Julio. He said, I didn't believe he was going to make it.
How great did that feel to talk to your brother after all those years as a prisoner?
Well, he didn't talk much, though. He said, how do you feel? Are you weak? Are you sick? Are you wounded? No, sir, I'm healthy. Well, that's the main thing. So we didn't talk too much. I didn't want to talk too much to him. I don't know. Surprises me. It was just I thought for a while I was dreaming.
Well, after all that, I can definitely see why you felt that way. And now after you were liberated, you got chosen a group of three soldiers that, from what I understand, kind of got the royal treatment. You got home more quickly than many of your fellow prisoners. And you even had kind of a homecoming tour that took you through Hawaii. Tell me about that.
When we arrived there for 3 days, they furnished a taxi. So we could go, three prisoners could go in that taxi all around the island. And then at night, they gave us a shower. we could go there, and they had a girl then there for each prisoner. She could go, he could go and eat with a girl there.
So you were the big cheese.
Yeah, but heck, we were just like kids when we were in primary. We didn't know what to talk about. 3 years, almost 4 years, is too long time to be here in the United States with people civilized. We didn't know what to talk about.
So you got to have dinner with a pretty girl, but after 3.5 years as a prisoner, I guess your worlds didn't really have all that much in common. I think we can all understand that. And then you eventually made it back to your native New Mexico. I guess when you take everything into consideration, you'd have to say you beat some pretty significant odds to be sitting with me right now and talking about it.
Very few prisoners came back. Good number died after they arrived in the United States. They were not good health, and they died. But I guess I was lucky.
I'm not going to argue with you there. Lucky indeed, certainly blessed, and I feel blessed to have shared this time with you today. Julio Barella, 91 years old, one of the first men drafted in New Mexico before the start of World War II, and now the last Bataan Death March survivor living in the area around Las Cruces. Julio told me that he had never done an interview like this before, ever, and that makes me feel so privileged to have been there to hear some of what he endured. Again, a reminder, I have photos of Mr. Barella and of the beautiful Bataan Death March Monument in Las Cruces on my blog at kmjnow.com, kmjnow.com, and also on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And up next, we're going to do something that we don't do that often on this program. Maybe we should do it a little more because I think it really adds some perspective. We're going to hear from someone who wouldn't be here if Julio Barella did not survive all of what he just detailed for us. It's his daughter, Anita Dawson. You'll hear from her when Hometown Heroes continues next on Newstalk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on Newstalk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, with you until Bulldog Baseball at 1:45. And before the break, we heard from Julio Barella, a 91-year-old Bataan Death March survivor I caught up with last week in New Mexico. Again, I encourage you to check out my blog at kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Mr. Barella and more information about the Death March and the unique connection that New Mexico and the city of Las Cruces in particular have with the march. I have photos of the Bataan Death March Memorial there, and I also had the chance while in New Mexico to talk to Julio Barella's daughter, Anita Dawson, about her father. She was quite candid about some of the struggles his ordeal led to down the road for her and her family, and I really think that she paints a very honest and very human picture about what her father has been through and why it matters to her and her family today. So here's my conversation with Anita Dawson, daughter of Bataan Death March survivor Julio Barella. Anita, is it safe to say that your dad is a hero in your eyes?
I've certainly looked up to him throughout my life, especially the older I got, the more I comprehended what happened to him during those years. It was an unbearable situation, and he survived. And he always said he doesn't know why he survived, but he survived. And he's always instilled in me a lot of beliefs on how to survive. He's thought it very important to learn how to love your fellow mankind and also how to help each other. Believe in each other, be loyal to your friends, be truthful and honest. And so those are qualities that I tried to keep. Although sometimes we all fail at one point, but my father did really believe in that because of the friends and fellow POWs that he had with him in prison camps. They helped each other so much that he always says they were his brothers, and he loves them all.
I know with all the ex-prisoners of war that you've been around, you've probably heard this a lot of times, but they like to say that prisoners of war help those who cannot help themselves, and I think that's what you just expressed about your dad. I'm curious, growing up with a father who was on the Bataan Death March, is it hard to ever complain about something because he can always top you with what he went through?
Well, he always does. He always has. And that's when I stopped to think about my situation. Maybe that's not as bad as I thought it was. And it's probably helped me cope with a lot of things that I found difficult to cope with, because he went through so much hell and he still survived and he's still got a pretty good outlook. There are things that he's experienced throughout the years that have, you know, it's affected him. It's affected a lot of things. His mental and emotional stability have been questionable at times, but he has been an awesome dad most of the time. And when he wasn't, I understood where that was coming from.
That puts a real face on what these guys went through. Do you ever stop and think, boy, I wouldn't be here if he didn't survive all of that, going from 145 pounds to only 83 pounds when he came back, almost dying so many times from starvation or anything else? And you and a lot of other people wouldn't be here without that intense survival instinct.
Well, yeah, but there's a lot of people that wouldn't be here if all our soldiers hadn't been out there fighting. Dad's here because of some of the fellow Americans that helped fight the war. The atomic bomb was a big issue with a lot of people because they feel they wouldn't have come back if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb. So there's a lot of reasons I'm here, just like most of my generation is here.
Exactly. Now, I talked to him a little bit about the memorial that's in Las Cruces, with the statue of the soldiers being helped along and all the footprints representing the thousands who were on that march. When you go by there and you look at it, is that significant in your mind? What's the meaning there?
Well, the meaning is that they were brothers. They helped each other. It was a Filipino and two of the fellow New Mexican soldiers who were in the memorial. It's been immortalized to me because it means that someone has tried to make this Remember Bataan. I know that a lot of people don't even know what Bataan is. I've never really seen except one movie with a very old, maybe 1946 or 47 movie with Gene Autry, I think. And that's the only movie ever made about the Bataan Death March or film of any type. There's been a lot of documentaries. A lot of prisoners have been interviewed. But I really want it to be more in the historical sense of the United States because it hasn't been taught in the schools too much. I think it's important for the youth to remember, to know what happened, because war doesn't come easy. A lot of people don't realize that there is a high price to pay when you go into a war. And I know that being a good American, you want to fight for the United States of America, and you want to be a part of the United States of America. But you have to keep in mind what price you're going to pay. And you have to make sure that that war is really needed. I think in my father's case and all World War II, that was something we really had to fight. We really were fighting for us, the United States of America. And I want the youth to know what that means. And I want them to remember Bataan. I want them to know what it is. Because it's important, just like everything else is important in history. We learn so much from it.
Is there one thing about your dad's experience with all the stories that he's shared over the years to you and knowing what you know about Bataan, is there one thing about his experience that maybe you take the most pride in or means the most to you or just grabs you and connects with you in a way more than anything else?
That's so hard to say because there's so many things that I can take from his stories and from his friends' stories because all his fellow POWs and Bataan Death March survivors who survived and I was blessed to know during the time that I was growing up because they were great friends, continue to be great friends. They were so wonderful. They would take you in as part of your family. You were part of their family, all of them. And again, I stress that the families with each individual person had struggles because of the, what you call post-traumatic stress or other things, because my father started experiencing nightmares probably when I was about 5 years old, I really started to notice the change in my father. My father was tried to be a happy person, but there was times when he would be dreaming and he would be praying the Our Father, and he would be begging someone not to shoot somebody else. And I finally figured out that it was when he was working in the fields. That particular day we were out in the field and we were picking chili, because he grew chili. And that night he dreamed that he was working on the farm in Cabana Tuan. And I think that one of the other POWs was killed that day because, actually 10 of them were killed, or 9 of them were killed, because one of them escaped. And he was saying the Our Father and praying for them not to shoot them, you know. So, yeah, I know it affected him a great deal, and that was the first realization I actually had, and I was pretty young. And I really thought, well, what's wrong with him? And later on I realized what was wrong with him. And it affected his moods. And a lot of us had had a lot of challenges. But overall, I think they've done tremendously well, considering all the obstacles they've had to face.
Is there anything else about your dad that you would like to share?
Well, I'm proud of him because he was a Hispanic soldier. And he has told me so many stories about some of, in from the Hispanic take. He had wonderful friends who were also non-Hispanic, and it just made it sound like there was no race, there was no color, and I was really happy to hear that because each one of them helped each other out.
Well, and you are hearing from Anita Dawson, daughter of Julio Barella Bataan Death March survivor. Baseball is next. That's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.